Welcome to LOA Today. I'm Walt Eason here with Life Coach Joel Elston. Today is Thursday, April the 11th, 2019. It is 8 a.m. in New York. It's 5 a.m. in Los Angeles. It's 1 p.m. in London, Sydney, Australia. It's actually around 10 p.m. Wherever you are in the world, thank you for joining us for another episode of LOA Today, your daily dose of happy. And I'm happy because Joel's back, and he's just telling me before the show how much he enjoyed his trip to Florida, particularly to Santa Maria Island, where his world-famous bench is located. This has got to be the most famous bench in the entire universe, Joel, don't you think?
Well, certainly my universe, Walt, that's for sure.
Yeah. No, it's cool. It's great. I love that you go back to that bench every year, too, because having an annualized routine like that, that's pretty much what that is, of returning to kind of like your spiritual roots and your developmental roots. That's a very cool thing you do. I like the fact that you do that.
Yeah, I just feel rejuvenated every time I visit. It's nice to have a place you can go. And for those of our audience or listening that doesn't know that for the last 25 years, basically, I've sort of used that bench. And in the beginning, I didn't even realize it was happening. Then one day I realized, wow, this bench has been sort of a center point for a lot of changes and a lot of decisions. And so I always sort of try to get there two or three times a year and sit there and just right now just really being grateful for all that's happened and see how we go forward with life. And I always have some type of discovery or epiphany and just really enjoy the whole thing. It's amazing.
That's cool. I love that you do that. I think that's fabulous. And also we were talking before we got started here about the script that Alex and I have been writing for The Grass is Greener, our new audio play that we're putting together. And we got the first draft done. Joel's going to be one of our reviewers. That's why we're talking about it. And I have to tell you, Joel, you were mentioning before the show about how you really respect the skill sets of people who have skill sets that are different from your own, which I totally echo. I understand what you mean. And I now understand it even greater, to a greater degree, because I've done writing before. I mean, I haven't done quite as much writing as you have. You'll write like four books or something like that. But I've written a couple books, and I know what kind of work goes into it. Let me tell you, it's that times three for script writing. It's unbelievable how hard script writing is. And I'm
amazed at it.
I was telling my sister that. Of course, she's a script writer. You know, she's been doing this for many years. And I wrote to her, I said, I have completely renewed respect for what you do when you write a script and what other script writers go through when they write scripts. And she wrote back to me something along this line, and I'll rephrase it to make it a little bit more G-rated. She says, I mean this with the greatest respect, no blank Sherlock. because it's tough. I mean, especially when you're writing for an audio play, because there's no visual. There is no visual to show, and they can't read what's on the page. The listener can't read what's on the page. The only thing they can hear is what they hear. So everything has to be presented through one sense. Boy, that is a challenge. Oh, just
wow.
Amazing. Yeah.
And that's something that you know, whether it's your skill set, you know, is writing like that, or I'm just fascinated how some things come easily to some people, and they're great at it. And that's sort of how the law of attraction, you know, when you understand your skill set and you can live within your skill set, and you know, one of the big Facebook things going around now is the young lady who wrote the code that was able to get a picture of the first black hole. And it sounds so easy, but this is an incredibly complicated story. If you ever see it on Facebook, it's really cool.
Okay.
But she is just, her brain is able to visualize code and visualize computer code and how to do all that. And again, I'm fascinated by we all have skill sets. I love my skill sets, and I'm grateful for the ones I have.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just fascinated by, like, your sister in screenplays and writing, the audio. All that stuff is so, I've written books, and I write them sort of in my voice. And and writing a book, words are on the page, and I don't think of myself as a great writer. I just, one of the things that I do, like in public speaking, I don't try to copy anyone else's style. I just try to talk the way I talk.
Right.
And it works. It goes over well. I know a lot of people that try to do public speaking, they sort of emulate or try to really basically copy someone else's style, and that never translates.
No.
All the public speaking courses I've ever been in have been like, be you. Don't worry about the ums and the ahs and all that stuff as much. You don't want that to be a big all-the-time thing. But you also, the audience relates to a few hums and haws every now and then. It actually makes it more conversational when you're speaking. And so knowing that's my skill set, that's great. But also being fascinated at everyone else's skill set. And I encourage, one of the things I do in life coaching is trying to help people first identify their skill set, and then how can you translate it into what works? You know, when I first was starting out in life, and I went to work for my dad at an insurance agency, while I was really good at the sales portion, I can relate to people very well. That's pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm.
But this is amazing that I was put into really the exact opposite of what I'm good at, and the results weren't good, and the results ended up being actually really, really negative.
Mm.
But it's something that I have to identify. It's something that I really am excited that we're able to identify our skill set, live within them, and the law of attraction can work in conjunction with your skill set when you allow it to happen.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. In fact, you were mentioning a moment ago speakers who include the ums and errs and ahs and want to cut down on that. Probably the best thing they can do is stop paying attention to the ums and errs and ahs, and they'll cut down on it. Because the ones who don't are the ones who build more of them into what they're talking about. It just undermines what their whole goal is. You know, that's law of attraction, right? You focus on stuff and you get more of it.
Exactly. And you know, we all have our own style. So it's just when I get up, I need a beginning and I need an end. There are some rules to it.
But mm-hmm.
I did a couple of trainings, and one of the gentlemen, he trains people for TED Talks. And the biggest thing he can do is he tells people, speak in your voice.
Mm.
And, well, that sounds obvious. What he means is speak in your style.
Right.
Speak in a way with your passion. You know, Tony Robbins is an excellent speaker. I love his message. He's very law of attraction oriented stuff. But not only is he able to do it, this man can do it for 9 hours straight on stage. I find that amazing.
It is.
And not lose any energy or message along the way. I love that in him. I love the fact that he has that much passion, that much ability. You know, he loses his voice almost every time he presents.
Yeah, right. That's the way he does,
you know, it. Yeah, and it shows he puts everything out there every time he does it. So people value. That's why he gets, you know, 1,000 people paying $150 a day to hear him talk.
Absolutely.
You know, that's pretty good stuff. He's a great guy and with a great message. But mm-hmm. if I try to be, well, I have a lot of the similar topics in what I talk, what he did, but my style's different.
Mm.
And it wouldn't work. That's not my skill set. Your sister's skill set, your skill set. And you know, I often work with people who are way out of their skill set, trying to force something that doesn't match their skill set into their life. And that creates this reverse law of attraction stuff. It's not reverse law of attraction, but it gets the negative side because you're trying to force your way into something that doesn't fit where you're at.
And oh, absolutely.
I just, you know, and that's what I, that, that's what, you know, the there's a, several psychiatrists that there's all different types of psychiatry and, you know, the directions we go. And, but there's a concept that, and I forget the exact psychiatrist, he doesn't believe that there is very much mental illness or it's not very pervasive. And he doesn't really believe in depression. What he really believes in is you have your world, your skill set, your abilities that you should be operating at.
Mm.
And when you're stuck operating below that, it's the difference in where you should be and where you are that creates that delusion, as he calls it, of depression. You're not fulfilling your destiny. So it's this, you know, unease in life. You're going through life with, oh, I don't adhere to that entirely. There's people with some severe illness, and depression can be a real thing for some people. But it's overdiagnosed because people aren't living a fulfilled life. Mm-hmm. And that's really important to understand. Being fulfilled and doing and living your passion goes a long way in helping you fulfill the law of attraction, because you're coming from a place of abundance when you're feeling that way.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. Interesting you should bring that up, too, about mental illness, because that was a topic Alex King and I discussed on yesterday morning's show. She's dealt with and continues to deal with a number of issues. She's got, agoraphobia and anxiety, and she was at one point diagnosed with bipolar and depression and a few other things in there, too. Yesterday's conversation was about how people who are diagnosed with or suffer from mental illness, how what they're dealing with other people in their family and their friends and so forth, and it was quite an interesting discussion from that perspective. But she also shared with me at one point in the conversation, first of all, the bipolar she'd been diagnosed with, she was diagnosed with it because her father was bipolar. So whoever was doing the diagnosing said, oh, well, if your father's guy, we can just assume you've got it. We'll start medicating you for that. And come to find out later on, she actually was not bipolar, which I kind of get the feeling happens a lot there. It seems like there's a whole bunch of emphasis on diagnosing quickly, giving meds, and you know, just being medication dispenser more than anything else. And I know you've talked about that too. I mean, there are certain psychiatrists who are all they're about is just diagnosing with meds, and then there's a smaller group that is much more dedicated to actually helping the human being to heal. That's a fairly right. Common thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. There's a branch of psychology that has sort of been left behind in the, what I call the medical age or the pharmaceutical age, but it's called transpersonal psychology, and it is very much what I believe in, and it's spiritual psychology. It's healing. You know, when you talk. And by the way, my normal disclaimer. This is not medical advice. I'm not a doctor.
Right.
We're talking theory here. Mm-hmm. And so if you're being seen by a doctor, it's up to you to make sure you work with your doctor and don't take us as anything other than just a discussion here. But, when you look at a lot of this, like bipolar, the general definition of bipolar is often just thought of, well, it's mood swings, you know, it's being happy, being sad. It could be fast, rapid cycling bipolar or longer periods when in and out of phases of mania and depression.
Right.
Or there could be a lot of life stuff that happens. There could be, you know, I've talked many times about, several of my clients, that, especially my foster care clients, that have been through incredibly difficult situations early in life and were diagnosed with depression versus sure they were depressed, but are they clinically depressed or are they situationally depressed?
Yeah.
I mean, you take a young person removing from his family, his mom dies while he's in foster care, he has nowhere to go, he's lost everything that means anything to him, and then you diagnose him as being depressed and he needs medication. Well, I'm baffled by that concept, and it's something that as we move forward, we're able to look at it. Yes, depression, it serves the body. Being sad, depressed, emotion, the idea that we're always supposed to be happy is not the point of the law of attraction. That's something that I think gets lost a lot. Always being able to respond from a positive perspective, but we're not expected to be robots and automatically be jumping up and down when somebody we love dies or,
right.
or dismiss that. It's not that. Somehow that gets interpreted as you're looking at the world unrealistically. I think law of attraction is working at the opposite. We're looking at the world extremely realistically. Stuff happens, and our response to it is how the universe is going to respond.
Mm-hmm.
That's very realistic.
Mm-hmm.
But it gets lost. I was sitting on the bench. This will do a little ADD switch on you here.
So, oh, okay. thank you for the heads up, by the way. I appreciate that.
Yeah, because you're going to try to track how I got here. There's no logic the way that I got to the next one.
I love that.
Let our audience know that.
Okay.
But it was early morning before the sun came up. I was sitting on the bench in Florida last on Monday morning, and I don't know why this popped into my head, and but I was going to share it today, and I was just not thinking about anything, just generally having a mindfulness moment where I was just trying to, you know, and it was a very clear statement that popped into my head, and I wanted to sort of, I thought about it a lot, and the statement was, desire is the resistance. Mm. And I'm like, what does that mean? And I'm like, okay, that's just random. But it was very clear that popped into my head. Mm-hmm. And as I've been sort of discussing it with some people and stuff, I think we often think that I need to want it really bad for it to happen. But sometimes the desire of wanting something turns into resistance because by wanting it, you're suggesting that you don't have it.
Yeah.
So when you desire something so strongly, the law of attraction is feeling, oh, he doesn't have these things. That's that you can want something too much. And that, so everybody that's listening is going, what? Well, now we're really confused. And it isn't about not wanting to be able to identify what you're, it's more about feeling like you're there versus the desire to get there. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes complete sense to me. I don't know about our audience, but it makes complete sense to me. In fact, the idea of desire being resistance, that resonates with me in a huge, huge way for a couple of reasons. One reason is it really takes the sting out of the negative association we have with the word resistance. Because those of us who are deliberate creators and we're trying to learn to, you know, gain more and more control over what happens in our lives, are people who we would have like this built-in anti-resonance against resistance. Like, oh, God, we got to avoid resistance. But, in fact, resistance actually serves us just as well as it works against us. I mean, it's a neutral tool, really. It's a neutral phenomenon.
Right.
And, you know, when we understand it that way, then, well, of course, I mean, anything that we think about is creating a limit of some kind. The only time that you have no limits is when there's literally no thoughts going on. Then there's no limits. But the moment you put a thought in, you say, okay, I'm going to start my structure. I'm going to build my foundation with my cornerstone here. And you just build a limit right there. It's not bad. It's just the way stuff works. That's the way logic, that's the way thought works, that's the way emotion works. You're piecing things together. And anytime you're piecing things together, you're creating limits. Those limits are good. That's how we create structures. That's how we create ideas. That's how we create everything that comes on into our lives. So, it's a great thing. It's not anything to be afraid of. It's a thing to be embraced. Of course, it's resistance. Good. Thank goodness for resistance.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that's the thing, because when in the beginning I thought you just had to want it so bad that you would bring it. And not realizing that wanting it so bad is actually giving the emotion, the vibration of not having it, versus understanding that you want it so bad you can go to the point of feeling you already have it. If you want it bad enough to understand you already have it, then the law of attraction responds to that. And I hear people trying to implement the law of attraction, and they don't realize that their desperation. I see it most, obviously the two topics we always talk about are money and relationships. That's where almost everybody gets into the law of attraction is one of those two avenues.
Most often.
And I see people in relationships particularly get so desperate for the relationship. They desire it so desperately that they create such a resistance, and they attract, almost inevitably attract, the wrong person every time.
Yes.
And that's fascinating to me. It really is, because it's not understanding. I know there's a lady in town. I know her from, we have crossed professionally a few times, and she cannot be without a man in her life. I mean, if one man leaves, the next day there's another man. It's just like she has to have a backup.
Right.
And she was asking me one day, she said, I don't understand why I keep finding the wrong guys.
Mm.
And I just said, I can't understand how you would expect to find the right one the way you're doing it. you're not filling the lack that you're feeling about the relationship is going to be continued to feel with the same people that will create the lack. I said, why don't you take 6 months off from having a relationship? Why don't you be without a man for 6 months?
Ooh.
And she said, said, "That's ridiculous." I said, "Okay." I said, "There's your answer right there." I said, or keep doing what you're doing. I'm fine either way. I'm just letting you know that it, you know, exactly. And that you see that. But she left, you know, she left home from her parents, and she, you know, got married young, her first husband. And then there was a second husband, there was even a third husband, a few boyfriends, and it just, she's a great lady, mm-hmm. but at the same time, her desperation for a relationship is creating the law of attraction picking up on the desperation side. Yeah. But again, desire. Her desire is gone way beyond desire and became an obsession, and instead of wanting a relationship, she's more worried about not having one, and that's what the law of attraction picks up.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's where the Abraham two-ended stick concept comes into play in a big way. The two-ended stick being that everything is actually two subjects. Every subject is actually two subjects. There's the thing end of the stick, and then there's the lack end of the stick. So there's lack of thing at the other end.
Right.
And that really, exactly. That, when I heard that concept for the first time, I said, oh my God, why didn't somebody explain that to me 30 years ago? That would have been so much more helpful if I'd learned it then. But I did learn it. That was the good part.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I was sitting on the bench. I kept, and for that message to be so clear, and while I know that message already, but for that, you know, obviously I was needing to hear that. Mm. And I don't know exactly how it applies or where it's at right now, but it was such clarity. That's what I want to share with the audience. It wasn't just a passing moment. It was a very clear message wherever that comes from. It was just, and it was random. I was not asking a question. So
right.
The answer was delivered with me just in a state of meditation. And the answer was very clear. Desire is the resistance. Remember that.
It came from where
you don't want to be.
Yeah, right. It came from what I call your inner Joel or my inner Walt. It came from that inside part of us. That's where it comes from. And those are the cool messages when you can identify them and get them and realize that's one of those things that I wasn't actually thinking about. It just kind of came to me. Those are cool because those are the ones we want to pay attention to and follow.
Well, and that's what my goal, you know, there were many times we were talking about that bench. There's many times I was sitting on that bench to, I was in desperate states. I was trying to figure out many life problems over the years. When I'm at the bench now, there's none of that going on. I'm just there in a gratitude state. I'm looking for, I'm just looking for those things, that are pretty relevant. You know, I'm whatever's there, I'm not looking for an answer that's scary or anything like that. I'm just looking for whatever. I'm not dealing with anything that's a problem now. And so I love this feeling of being able to just, okay, instead of me asking for a certain message, you deliver the message that I need, and I don't even know that I need it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the beauty part of it. I can be more open to that.
Yeah, that's nice. That's a good place to be in. Because when you're in that place, you're open to all kinds of cool stuff coming in. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
Something else that came out of my conversation with Alex yesterday, we were talking, I think this is actually after the program, we were talking about some of the stuff that she deals with. She has a lot of stuff that she deals with. She has made tremendous progress since all this stuff first came on her. Because all this came on her in like her mid-20s. You know, she'd had kind of a pretty much a normal life up until then. And then all of a sudden, bam, she got hit with all this stuff. And it really, you know, disrupted her life. But she's made a lot of progress in regaining her life back. And that's really great. But one thing that she was talking about is how she will, you know how a human being will start playing out that negative spiral. And they'll get a thought going about, you know, how, I don't know, a relative will die, you know, not that the relative is dead, it's just if you have a series of events, it'll lead to somebody dying, or it'll lead to some dread event of some kind. And she has this tendency, like so many people have, to just take scenario X, whatever X is, and bring it down to its worst possible result, and just kind of stay there. And my comment to her was, well, do you ever try to take it out beyond that? Do you try to treat that as a springboard to, you know, something good coming out of it? And she said, no, I never really do that. I said, well, yeah, I talk to Joel sometimes. So I think she may actually give you a call at some point. But, like, just from a general perspective, can you just talk about that for a minute? Because, first of all, it is very easy to get into that pattern of just slipping into, oh, worst case scenario, worst case scenario, worst case scenario, and just getting stuck there. But it's also very cool to have a worst case scenario happen, and then you jump out of it, and it becomes this big, big springboard to something great. Talk about that for a second.
So Well, you know, the first of all, the tendency to use, you know, the term that I often get real positive feedback, you know, the tendency of us humans to analyze every scenario is a protective technique.
Mm-hmm.
It's perceived as a protective technique. It's not really, but it's perceived as that. Let me assume the absolute worst so I can prepare for it, you know, and then I'll go on. And then I'll just live there and I'll be prepared for whatever happens. Mm-hmm. Well, there's obvious. I didn't even get into how that can negatively affect the law of attraction.
Oh, yeah.
Prepare for the worst and then invite it in. But there is a way to say, you know, go to the point of if we do have that tension, let's look at the worst case scenario and then say, how do I build from that? What if that really does happen? I'll give an example for me. When I was in the middle of my addiction, I was doing some very antisocial things. I was committing crime. I was supporting a gambling addiction by taking money that wasn't mine. It's called stealing by most people's terminology. And while I didn't really view it as stealing, I was always planning on putting it back. At the end of the day, it wasn't my money, and there's nothing other than stealing in that. So I did that, and then my big fear was going to jail. My ultimate fear, there was just nothing worse that could happen than have a felony conviction and go to jail. My life would be over. There's no point. I would plan on killing myself. I had all this narrative in my head of what was happening. And I just, there was no scenario of me going to jail that would be good. That was the worst case scenario. And I feared it every day. I kept waiting to, you know, after a period of time, the company I was working for, I was managing several different group homes, and I had an accounting sheet that I had to turn in that I wasn't even able to balance it. And I knew I was caught, and I just kept waiting and waiting. Finally, I had to turn it in. And I decided to say, you know, I'm tired of living this way. I told my manager everything that had happened. I've been stealing. I gave her all the proof. And she was baffled. She couldn't believe it was happening. And I just gave it all up. And I said, I know you got to press charges, and I'm prepared to deal with that. Well, I wasn't prepared. I just didn't know how I was going to handle it. It was a worst-case scenario. And a few months passed before they were able to get everything done, and I was working at a different place, and the police randomly showed up and they arrested me. And there was a moment of like, everything's done. There's nothing after this. I'm not ever going to be able to make a living again. I have a felony. I will get a felony conviction off of this. I won't be able to work in any of the fields that I've ever or get licensed in anything ever again. What a sad state of affairs. I don't know what I'm going to do. And so I went to jail. And that morning, it was October 11th of 1995. You don't ever forget that day.
I'm sure.
I share this in my book, and I share it like new talks. But the most bizarre thing that had ever happened that I couldn't imagine happening happened. They put me in the jail cell. They shut after the body cavity search, by the way, which wasn't pleasant. The next step was they put you in your cell. And I got shut in this room alone, and I had the most unexpected emotion you could ever imagine. I was like, oh, thank God, this is over. my most awfulized moment, the worst moment, I feared it for years, that there's a chain of events leading to this horrible moment of me going to jail in handcuffs and everything being lost, and my emotion was the exact opposite of what I feared.
Wow.
I had been to places that were far worse than jail. My fear of jail was far more debilitating than jail was itself. And then I look at it, that not only did jail and my felony conviction eventually lead me into the field of counseling, it became a credential that is different than what most people have. I have the ability to relate to clients that most people that in traditional therapy roles can't do. There's very few therapists or coaches that have a felony conviction that will somebody go, well, you don't know what it's like to be here. Well, yes, I do. There's a whole benefit that I was able to find from the most awful, quote unquote, most awful moment in my life.
Mm.
So we do have this tendency to awfulize, but if we can then get to a growth mindset, a fixed mindset when we awfulize, we stop at the awfulizing point and say, there's nothing worse than this. A growth mindset is, how am I going to use this? How am I going to use this horrible event to build, to grow? What am I going to get from that? Mm-hmm. And it's a shift in thinking. It's simply a perspective change. But in retrospect, me being locked up in jail is one of the greatest things that ever happened to me. It started a whole chain of events I never could have perceived. What I thought was the end of my life was the beginning of an incredible journey. It sounds very, you know, it sounds almost made up. It's almost too impossible to happen. Yes. What happened. But here we are.
Yeah, here we are. Well, kind of continuing the theme of law of attraction, while you were telling us that fabulous story, Alex King joined us here on the platform. So let me introduce you guys. Joel, meet Alex. Alex, meet Joel.
Hi.
Alex, great to meet you. Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, thank you.
That was an incredible story.
Well, thank you. It's obviously that, you know, that took place over many, many years, and to have that, you know, I've had multiple times in my life where, you know, there's this anxiety, this fear-based stuff. I'm not only am I in recovery from addiction, I'm recovery from depression, I'm in recovery from anxiety. It is something that I learned how to use the momentum of the negativity to just rebound. The awfulizing effect eventually led to a rebound, and the five worst days of my life eventually become the five most pivotal turning points of my life that I don't necessarily view them as traumas anymore. I view them as platforms for change, and all that's my perspective in charge of all of that.
It's pretty cool. I was telling him how we had the conversation yesterday also about how mental illness affects family members and how it affects friendships. And I didn't get into detail about what we talked about yesterday, but you were talking yesterday about how your father's bipolar and other issues that affected you and your siblings and your mom and all that kind of thing. So I'm going to go back mm-hmm. to Joel on that one. Talk a little bit about how this stuff affects other people in the lives of those who experience these debilitating circumstances.
Well, I have my biological grandfather was an alcoholic who committed suicide. My biological father was a compulsive gambler who committed suicide. I have, if I do a basic test, a psychological test or one of these life tests, like, you know, looking at genetics, what's the most likely way I will die? It's suicide. I mean, suicide is the cause of death. I'm not trying to make light of that because it sounds like I'm joking, but it's something that runs in my family, that mental illness runs in my family. And the idea of why there can be genetic components to this, there's a different genetics suggests that DNA is it can't be changed. Well, there's also a term called epigenetics where DNA isn't necessarily just what it is. So the idea that, you know, there's almost a bias when you go see someone, a doctor, and say, well, your father or mother has depression or schizophrenia or any other. Oh, well, clearly it's almost you give them a bias toward, yep, you're because your father was bipolar, you're bipolar. And,
yeah.
And what sends us down the path of that is I'll tell a quick story, Alex, about it. It's more of a physical condition, but I have a friend three or four years ago, super fit guy, he's in his mid-40s, known him for years, lives in Florida, and I got a call from his wife, and we used to work out together. He got a call from his wife, said, you really need to come see Steve. He was shockingly diagnosed with a liver cancer yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
I was blown away by that. I was like, this, first of all, I didn't believe it. I went, I don't believe that. And she goes, no, it's real. She said, we're going to see the oncologist next week. So I adjusted my schedule, went down to see him, and I could not believe what I saw, Alex. This was one of the most healthy, fit people you've ever seen. He was gray. He had lost, I forget the number, but it was like 17 pounds in a week.
Wow.
He was literally dying. So I saw him on a Friday. I couldn't believe it. I said, are you eating or going to the gym? And he goes, no, I'm just too tired and exhausted. I can't.
Mm-hmm.
So his appointment was on Monday. And so I waited all day to hear from them, and they were in there all day, and I was expecting the worst. Like, what do they do, rush him into surgery? I didn't know what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And he called me, and he said it was very weird. They kept doing tests, and he didn't know why they were doing tests. And a little while, they said, we have no idea how this happened, but your results have gotten mixed up with someone else. You do not have cancer or any sign of cancer. You're in perfect health.
Wow.
His wife said the moment he heard that, his color came back. It went to Chipotle, and he probably ate like 5,000 calories. He was in the gym that night, and within 1.5 weeks after that, he restored his health. He almost mentally killed himself with a diagnosis of cancer.
So yeah.
There's a book by Dr. Joe DePinzip called You Are the Placebo, and it is this concept that we mentally do a lot. And so when you have a doctor tell you, and I'm not speaking to your case directly, but when you hear someone say, oh, you're bipolar, and it's based on the fact that your dad was maybe bipolar or maybe mm-hmm. not, but it's not our job to diagnose him, but it automatically, psychiatry, they cheat by saying, oh, your father's bipolar, you're up and down moods, you're clearly bipolar diagnosis, and they'll even medicate you for something that you don't even yeah. have based on circumstantial evidence, and then you start living as a bipolar person, and that was never mm-hmm. you in the first place.
Right. That's exactly what happened to me. Well, partially, because I never believed I was bipolar because I'd seen it firsthand, so I was like, nah, I don't know. I was like, I'll take your medication, but I don't know about this diagnosis.
and I'm glad, you know, and again, we always do our disclaimers, and, you know, you obviously need to listen to your doctor, but when I used to run group homes, I had these kids in the group home, and mm-hmm. there were three doctors that we used, and this is how bizarre the system is. I had one doctor that everybody was bipolar.
Oh, okay.
No matter who went to see him, so and then another one believed that everybody was depressed, and another one believed that everybody was schizophrenic.
Jeez.
And so what
wow.
I did was, so what we did was, this is true. We had the staff observe the kids for a couple weeks before they had their appointment, and we would make an appointment with a doctor that best fit which diagnosis we thought was real. And he was universal. I mean, they were almost always universally diagnosing the same thing.
Oh.
When I was 13 or 14, and I went into high school or whatever type of how old that would be, 15 maybe, and I'd always, you know, I have a really high IQ and I always did well in school, but I wasn't able to do homework or I wasn't able to do a lot of content. I had really bad ADD. Well, back in the day, they didn't diagnose that, but the mm-hmm. big diagnosis back in my childhood was dyslexia. Mm-hmm. So I was diagnosed by a psychologist as having dyslexia. Well, so when I read the diagnostic criteria she provided for me, I'm going, even at 15, I go, nope, that's not me. I don't mix up my letter. Well, by definition, you don't realize you're doing it. I'm going, no, I'm pretty sure I know I'm. And I said, I just can't concentrate. She said, no, you can't concentrate because you're mixing up your words. And finally, and my mom said, quit arguing with the professional. You got dyslexia. So I didn't know what I had. It wasn't any damn dyslexia. It was fact. I mean, it was going to be dyslexia. So at some point, you know, they're like, okay, we're going to give you a reading specialist. I go, oh my God, it's not a problem with me reading. It's the fact I cannot sit there and, you know, understand it. And I can read it, I understand the words, but if I don't have interest in it, I can't focus on it. I'm just, mm-hmm. I'm visualizing squirrels running in circles when I'm reading about Julius Caesar and boring stuff like that. And so as time went on, you know, I realized but I started accepting this diagnosis of dyslexia. More than the diagnosis of dyslexia, I just said, well, because part of that, they said, well, he's dyslexic and he's intellectually lazy. He doesn't want to learn. He doesn't, he's just being defiant. I started being, I am defiant. I'm just, and so I went from all A's in middle school to, they're all A's and B's, and to B's and D's, and not really participating in high school. I went through a situational depression. I started just to not believe in myself because I was told all of these things. And the only reason I tell this long story is this is an example of how misdiagnosis or how we can get into these, you know, the sort of the diagnosis of the day. It's like every five-year-old, by definition, especially five-year-old boys, by definition, are ADHD. That's five-year-old boy. It's five-year-old boy. You should not be putting Ritalin in five-year-old boys because they're not meant to sit still. That's their little brains computing and programming. They need to go touch it. They need to talk about it. They need to break it. They need to look at it. And that's how they learn. But not understanding that and saying, well, he can't focus. Well, those are the diagnoses that we get out there. So the problem with diagnosis is we then start to hear it enough. My friend diagnosed with cancer could have died, not from cancer, but the diagnosis of cancer. And that is hard to me.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
It is crazy.
It really is. So, And so we've talked a lot about that kind of stuff, but being able to pivot from, you know, there's a growth mindset and there's a fixed mindset. The growth mindset is always about no matter what happens, I'm going to pivot from it. I'm going to grow. I'm going to learn versus this happened to me and I'm sort of a victim of it. Angelina Jolie had both of her breasts removed because she had genetics that said she possibly could get breast cancer. She made a decision based on what was right for her.
Well, right.
There's these genetic tests you can do, and the genetic test will tell you what you have a propensity to, you know, a disease. Oh, you have a propensity for this cancer or this disease. Well, I don't want that in my wheelhouse. I don't want to put that into the law of attraction field of that. It's just not even something I want to entertain. I don't want that test done. I don't want to know about that stuff because I'm in perfect health. I'm on no medications. I'm not going to accept any of that stuff. So I don't want to put, as my friend put that, you know, dying mode. He was dying. He had liver cancer. Nobody hardly ever survived liver cancer. And so he started to believe that, and his body reacted as if he had cancer. And you also see the other side of it where, no, I don't have that. I'm not going to accept that. And the law of attraction will respond. Your body will respond to your reality. And so it can be debilitating to have the wrong diagnosis and also what our brain does with that diagnosis. There, prostate cancer for men is a big thing. And they do a test called a PSA test. They measure this enzyme in your body. Well, there's a medical push to do away with that test entirely. Because it's inaccurate. Men, as they age, they have that PSA naturally raises. But what happens is they're finding, oh, your PSA is high, so you may have prostate cancer. Well, there's two factors here. A lot of prostate cancers grow slowly over 3 decades. I mean, you don't need to address every one of them. Some of them are super slow growing and they will not kill you. And the other is the invasive act of having to do the biopsy and potentially remove the prostate, which has a lot of other issues. So there's a big push that it isn't really changing anything by knowing that. It's you're over-diagnosing and you're over-treating because of this. And they're giving a lot more credibility to the fact that the mental damage done by suggesting somebody PSA is high is worse than the few cancers it does sort of weed out. And that's the medical field looking at that kind of stuff. There's more value to that now, and it's really important we look at that and what you believe is your reality. And when you put something into your belief system, that becomes your reality. And if I'm a loser, I'm a loser. When I was a loser, I was a loser. When I was lazy, I was lazy. And these are things people told me that I bought into reality.
Mm-hmm.
It's so easy to do, isn't it? To bring the stuff into reality and not even realize that we're doing it. I mean, it seems like we are responding to what's happening rather than creating what's happening when we're in those places.
Right.
That's so true. That creation piece that we, since we're deliberate creators, and when somebody gives you something that doesn't match what you're trying to create, that can interfere with what you're trying to create. And we as humans in a protective mode do have this ability to almost to automate a default situation to say, well, what's the worst thing that can happen here? I told this story a few weeks ago to Walt. I have this really cool thing I get from the post office every day. They send me a picture of the mail that I'm getting every day. You sign up for it. It's really cool. And so I see the envelopes I'm getting. And it's something that it helps me. Like if I'm, you know, I bill some of my clients and if a check's supposed to be here today, I see it. So I know to get the mail early or whatever. And so it's a cool thing. Well, one day Walt and I are on the phone doing a show and I'm checking right now. I'm looking at my computer. I can see my email. This came up. I said, oh, what's my mail today? Well, I was at my office and doing this call and the IRS had sent me a letter. And now I am really, I go super honest with the IRS. I go to the other side of cautious with them. I report every penny of income. I do everything I can. But my mind went to, what does the IRS want? What does the IRS want? What's the IRS trying? Oh my God, do I owe them money? Am I in trouble? And I spent the entire day, I could not get my mind off of what was good. There was no reason the IRS should be writing me. And I spent the entire day doing this. So I rushed home. Usually I go to the gym. I said, no, I'm going to rush home and get the mail because I got to address that. I got to call the IRS. Turns out I had overpaid them like $1.23. And I spent the entire day awfulizing what that envelope could be. Now, logically, I knew that if it's a really bad problem, the IRS will send something certified mail. They won't just send you a normal envelope. So I knew all that, but I still spent the entire day worrying about all that. And those are the things that I still, even though I've come so far in those areas, especially if I'm caught off guard, if I'm anticipating something, I'm like, oh my gosh, I can sit there and awfulize everything, and I work hard on not doing that, but it's hard to pull away from that. I'm so much better than I used to be, but it is something that we do have a tendency as humans to do. And of course, the law of attraction. Now, in this case, it didn't create any more problems, but if it would have stayed in that vibration or that negative, awfulized state, then other negative things are going to come about. And it's such an important factor when we look at all this to really understand this process and how it unfolds.
I'm thinking about that. $1.23 that you worried about for 8 hours, that means you were worrying at a rate of 15 cents an hour. I mean, what a great pay rate that is, 15 cents an hour.
And that's so not me. And all the stuff that I'm, worst case scenario, no matter what the IRS throws at me, I deal with the IRS on behalf of my client a lot. A lot of my clients get into severe problems. I'll often do joint phone calls. They're an incredible, they have such a negative reputation, but they work very well with people. They work out payment plans. They have a thing called offer and compromise for people that can't pay, and they can literally erase a bunch of your debt. So there's a ton of stuff they can do for you. And I've never had them be mean when I'm on the phone. So my fear was totally irrational, but it was just, it's just a base mindset that we revert back to. And that's mm-hmm. when we find, and that's the unintentional attraction we put into our life. And I'm using these examples, but it can happen in any area. You can overthink, well, what did this person mean by that? I haven't heard back from a text from my friend, so obviously my friend's mad at me or dead, one of the two things.
Yes!
A million other things, you know, all those things. But we have that tendency to say, well, what's wrong here? And it's something that you just don't have control over until you learn to deal with it and you learn to have control. That's the big key.
How do you learn that?
Good question.
Uh, It's like anything else. It's about practicing it using logic, sort of a cognitive behavioral approach where you logically sit there and say, okay, this isn't serving me. And not only is it not serving me, it's detrimental to me. So I have to, most of the time, obviously not on the IRS day, but most of the time I have the ability to sit there and logically process this and, say, what am I going to do with this or what does this mean? I don't have an answer. And the only thing I can control is my perspective or my attitude for it. I can't control someone else's behavior. I have no control over what was in that IRS envelope. I have no control over my son's behavior. I have no control over what other my clients do. I can only control my perspective of those things. So when I give up control or belief of control in those areas, it becomes easier because it's a lot easier just to deal with what is in my control. And almost always that's simply my perspective toward things. First of all, I get it sounds so incredibly simple, but it's the hardest thing that we as humans have to deal with psychologically, I believe, is separating what's in our control from what is our perception of what is in our control versus our perception of what's out of our control. If you're worried about someone else's actions or you're worried about what's going to happen here or something that is clearly out of your control, you're actually putting emotion into the field. It's like worrying is praying for what you don't want. It literally is sitting saying, okay, this is what I don't want. Please give it to me. Yeah, that's right. What worry puts out into law.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So that's why, when I work with, one of the things I always see is I work with families of all different origins and Napoleon Hill, I'm going to say it's Napoleon Hill, but it may be somebody else. But Napoleon Hill had a statement in one of his books or one of his talks. He said, if you took all the money in the United States and divided equally among all the people, and let's say everybody ended up with $2 billion apiece. In 5 years, the people who are wealthy before you divided up will be wealthy again, and the people who were poor will be poor again. Not because of anything other than their belief system. Families get stuck in poverty. Families get stuck in, patterns that get handed down because a lot of it is just what we believe. And it's not true beliefs. It's just beliefs that just sort of dictate our lives, and most of it is out of our control, but not understanding the our most powerful asset is our perspective. I'm in charge of that. If I get to choose today, I get to decide, am I happy today? No one else gets to decide that for me. Events can't make me happy. That's a big something that, other things can't. Now, it can't be great things happen in life, but if my happiness is dependent on another human or another event, I'm not truly happy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's pretty big stuff.
We talked about, Walt and I talked about that a lot. That's where most people get with the law of attraction messed up is wanting it. I want it so bad. Desire is, I want it so desperately that I'm actually signaling that I don't have it, and I'm really signaling a lack versus living like I'm there. Early in my addiction recovery, I actually had somebody, they weren't a law of attraction person, but what they said made a lot of sense at the time, and it worked, and I now see the law of attraction. They said, why don't you act as if you're a normal, responsible human being? And I'm like, okay, well, that's an idea. Because I was anything but in the middle of my addiction. Well, and I started to act like I wasn't. Sure enough, in the first 6 months of my addiction recovery, this is true, I didn't believe, I thought I was faking it. I really did. I said, well, I don't believe any of this crap, but I know I can't. I'm facing jail for the stuff I've done. I have to fake this. I have to, I didn't gamble. I changed a lot of my patterns. I worked a lot of, worked several jobs. I built my way up. Well, 6 months into it, I'm going, yeah, I'm faking it. I go, well, yeah, I'm faking it, but I haven't gambled in 6 months, and my life's getting better. And I'm like, wow. So it didn't matter if I was I was acting as if, and that advice was amazing. And so act as if, I don't have control over what other people do, which is the truth. But letting go of that, I can't spend an ounce of energy worrying about someone else's behavior or their response. I'm going to have to respond if the behavior affects me, but I'm not in control of their behavior, or fear that this is going to happen this way, or that you know, anxiety is an epidemic in today's world because we have access to we see what everybody else is doing. We're not fulfilled. You know, I've had several other life coaches that have called me and go, well, how, you know, in secret, you know, and saying, look, I'm struggling. I don't know how to make a living in this. How are you successful at it? What do you got to do? And it living in lack of abundance, and they don't understand they're preaching abundance, but yet they're fear based, and that doesn't work. I mean, because the law of attraction responds to the real emotion, not to the actual thought. The thoughts are irrelevant. The emotion is what law of attraction responds to.
Mm-hmm. What is it that you think is the difference between the person who is dealing with a difficult circumstance and bounces out of it? It becomes a springboard. Like when you told the story about how you got thrown in prison and all of a sudden you had a completely different reaction from what you expected, versus somebody who ends up in a similar kind of circumstance and they end up staying there. Why is it that in one case one person springboards out and the other person just kind of stays there?
Well, the difference, I mentioned the term growth mindset and a fixed mindset, is one has a fixed mindset where you accept the awfulized version of what just happened. There's a growth mindset that says, this is going to propel me to great things. I'm going to use this as a springboard. The resilience factor versus a fixed mindset. The resilience factor exists in a growth mindset. There's a big push in trauma. One of the things, the example we've used before, and I'll tell this quickly, World War II, our country was attacked. Our men and women responded in an incredible way. We literally built up a huge arsenal and went abroad and just kicked butt. We defeated, I mean, we were huge in defeat of the evil that was attacking, and we did huge fact. Now, atrocities took place. People died. Young men standing by their best friends saw their heads. But the perspective of it, we had no choice but to go to war. Fast forward several years, Vietnam happens. That was a war that most people thought we shouldn't be there. When the people came back, the people that fought the war, we were really a proxy war for somebody else. And, you know, the a lot of people were spit on. They were treated with great disrespect.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the Vietnam people had developed post-traumatic stress syndrome from all the atrocities they've seen in war. Mm-hmm. The same atrocities in World War II existed, but the perception of why we were there was different. One was perceived as a waste of time and we were really killing babies, versus the other was we were saving our country. The same war, the same type of events took place, a perspective of why we did it. When we look at it, there's a growth mindset of, I am resilient and will, this has happened for a reason. The five worst things to me, five of the six worst things that ever happened in my life turned out to be incredible growth mindsets for me and moved forward. I made a decision to make jail a growth mindset. I made a decision to make a felony conviction a credential. I did that decision. We're in charge of that. Unfortunately, there's a narrative out there that sort of leads us to believe we're in charge of those things. You're a victim of. The victimhood is what kills us.
Yeah. Boy, that's really true. We always like to end on a positive note. We got a minute left, so I'm going to ask you to answer this in 30 seconds if you can. What's the way out of
Good
that?
Good luck with that.
What's the way out of that? Because you just painted a terrific mess. how do we get out?
Again, your perspective. You're in charge of that. You get to decide how something affects you. The stuff that's in your control, go control it. The stuff that's not in your control, let go of it and live that. We weren't sent here, you know, the old saying, the old statement, you know, a ship is safest in a harbor, but that's not what ships are made for. Mm-hmm. We weren't sent here to not be battered. Life is going to kick our butts, and those butt kickings propel us where we need to go. I'm grateful for all that has happened to me, good, bad, and ugly, because it may be the man I am today. I'm a better person because of what happened in my life and how I responded to it. So it's just you have control of that. It's sort of like Dorothy. All she had to do was click her heels together and be home. You're in charge of it. It's that simple. Your perspective dictates these outcomes. And when you learn you have control of your perspective, you have the ultimate superpower.
Perspective is the ultimate superpower. Well, this has been quite the discussion, and thank you for sharing those. I love the stories that you were telling there. Some of them I've heard before. Some of them were new.
Me too.
They were really, really good. So thank you. And Alex, thanks for jumping in. That was great to see you when you came out of the platform there. So
no problem.
It was a wonderful thing. Thank you also.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you guys. Nice to meet you. Alrighty.
Nice to meet you too, Joel.
And thank you to our live stream listeners. Thank you to our podcast listeners as well. And we'll see you all next time here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody.